Hey, listeners, it's your host, Dacia. So if you're in any of the regions of Texas and the rest of the country that have been experiencing crazy rain and flooding lately, this episode is for you. And if you just like good contemporary opera, you'll like this too. Composer David Hanlon and I talk about living through hurricanes here in the Gulf Coast and about his opera After the Storm. It's basically a thrill ride, so hold on to your hats, hunker down with canned goods if possible. Assuming that you make it through this episode without blowing away, make sure to go to iTunes, subscribe to us, rate us, and review us. And congratulations for making it through. And one more thing in light of the awful events that happened this weekend in Orlando. Love your neighbors, okay? Even the ones you don't like. In fact, especially them. Okay, enjoy the episode. My name is Dacia Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock, and I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, but I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. Today, joining us from WAMU, by the way, with engineer Toby Schreiner, who works on the Diane Rehm Show, making me 1 degree from her and like 2 degrees from Kevin Bacon, is conductor and composer David Hanlon. Hey, David. And as a conductor, David has worked on the Castleton Festival and with the San Francisco Opera. As a composer, he often works with the Houston Grand Opera and HGO Co., which I'll have him describe in a little bit here. And HGO Co. actually just performed his work After the Storm, which we're going to be talking about today. So, David, thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, I know you you live in D.C. now. What's your affiliation with Houston?
So, I moved to Houston in 2007, and I quickly hooked up with HGO Co. And HGO Co. is a part of Houston Grand Opera that its charge is having a relationship with the larger Houston community and collaborating, communicating, and a lot of other things that start with the letter CO with it. And so, they did this wonderful project that then called The Refuge. And it was the first really big HGO Co. project. They got Chris Theofanidis to write this music for this oratorio that would look at 7 refugee groups from the city. I mean, there's so many refugees groups in there. It's like one of really the great cities for accepting refugees and immigrants. Mm. So this just focused on 7 of them, and they needed somebody who could work with both sort of opera singers and also learn Indian solfege so we could work with sitar players and have everybody interact. And so that was right up my alley. That's one of the things which I really love about the department and all of the various projects that it's had, that it's really not, it's trying to basically treat, opera as something that is just part of like the lifeblood of the entire city rather than it's just something that's taking place in one fancy building downtown. Well, what happens there is pretty great too.
Well, and it sounds like the topics are all very contemporary and kind of relevant to what people are thinking about now, like undocumented workers and like your opera After the Storm even.
Yeah.
When did you write this opera, and what inspired you to write it?
So we've been writing it, almost over 2 years. It's really something. This is a commissioning project that HGO Co. is doing right now as part of its Song of Houston project. So it's looking for these sort of slightly larger scale operas that they've been doing recently that would really resonate with Houston communities. So the one right before me was this really spectacular work by the composer Gregory Spears and librettist Royce Vavrick called O Columbia, partially about the Columbia disaster, but also just about what it's like to be an astronaut and to be an explorer. And they made this incredible work based on that. And so that was obviously, NASA is something that's very richly resonant with the Houston community. I mean, it's when you say Houston, we have a problem. I mean, everybody knows what you're talking about there. So for me, when I moved to Houston, well, very soon after I started working at Houston Grand Opera, Hurricane Ike struck. So that was back in 2008. It was really quite an introduction to the region.
I think that we should stop for just a moment and explain Hurricane Ike and what happened.
Oh, yeah.
So Hurricane Katrina had hit New Orleans in 2005. And of course, as you probably already know, it was just absolutely devastating and horrific. Well, then soon thereafter, this Hurricane Rita was barreling down on the Houston area. Mm-hmm. It was a Category 5. Everybody ran for the hills. It was just unbelievable. Well, then at the last minute, Rita turned and went another direction, didn't hit Houston at all. So then right after that, Hurricane Ike comes along and is headed to Houston. But everybody after Rita was sort of like, it'll be fine.
Yeah.
And many people stayed here.
Yep.
And it turned out that Ike was actually also a pretty devastating storm.
Absolutely. Now, I mean, we heard about that constantly when we're talking to people about their Ike experience. Everybody kept on referring to like how for Rita, the evacuation was much worse than the hurricane. So there was this just sense of like, you know, stand your ground, batten down, you know, tough it out. Because who knows, it'll probably turn at the last second. And certainly for me, I mean, I thought it would be just like Rita, you know, I'll have all this like bottled water and this battery powered radio and this flashlight that, you know, and I'll never actually use it, but at least I'll have it. And then it was actually really good that I had it. I mean, it was really extraordinary. I mean, before the hurricane hit, just the anticipation in the air, and of course, like the sound itself. I remember my my aunt-in-law calling me at 3 o'clock in the morning to make sure I was okay, and just thinking, it's not at all weird that she's calling me at 3 o'clock, because who is sleeping in the city right now? It's so loud. And then, of course, you know, the days after, and like everybody being out of power and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, my wife was a reporter for the Houston Chronicle. She was down in Galveston. And Houston had it bad during Hurricane Ike, but Galveston had it much, much worse. Mm-hmm. It really took on historic flooding.
Yeah.
And she was telling me like all these incredible stories of, it's like you were saying that, you know, people would be out barbecuing their food and being like, you know, this happens, you know, we live on this island, we have hurricanes, you know, most of them end up blowing over. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they were very even keeled about it. And then some of those same people called my wife in the middle of the hurricane to say, we made a big mistake actually staying. Can you send someone to come get us? And of course, like, you can't.
Yeah.
Because it's the middle of a hurricane. The best you can do is say, like, I'll make sure that, like, someone comes finds you the second that, you know, there's an all clear. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, like, when I was thinking about, okay, well, what can I pitch as, like, a Houston resonant story? I mean, that immediately leapt to the front of my mind. I mean, it's such, like, an incredible moment to live through.
Yeah.
And as of course, like you talk to any, one of the great things about working on this is that I tell anybody that I'm working on like a hurricane story, and like they'll tell me their hurricane
story.
Oh
yeah, everybody's got
really
one.
Really great.
It's so funny. It's like you could be out for drinks with friends years after a hurricane has happened, and you just bring it up, and then automatically everybody starts going, well, I was in my apartment and the power went out at 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, it was everybody's got their thing. But it's very Houston. Like I've personally been through, what, 3 or 4 hurricanes in my life living here. And I mean, people hear hurricane and they think big rainstorm. No, it is a horrifying experience. The windows on your home are shaking. The power goes out often. You wind up without water. Trees are falling. Tornadoes are happening all over the place.
Yeah.
The rain is blowing sideways. It's the city completely floods.
It makes you
wonder
biblical.
Why you live here. Frankly.
But no, but that's also, I mean, like, that's really what, like, the piece is about, because on one hand, you have sort of, like, when you're really facing the fury of a hurricane, full force, I mean, sort of, like, in its full biblical proportions, I mean, it's really, it's like, how can anybody want to, like, stand in the way of that?
Yeah.
The same thing, one of the other things that, like, we often hear about when we're asking people about their experiences is that as terrible as sometimes, like, you know, immediately after the storm can be, I mean, all sorts of like terrible things.
Mm-hmm.
a lot of people talk about it as a really beautiful time too, because it's also when like communities like really come together, like down in Galveston, like, you know, everybody was cooking their spare food for each other. Everybody was coming out to help each other. You know, when I was laid up in my apartment, just listening to the radio all day for like want of anything else that I could do while I was, you know, just stranded there. You know, it's like you have everybody calling into, you know, the radio stations, you know, saying like they're distributing ice at this parking lot. If you can get to this parking lot, you know, you can hold on to your food for another day. And so, and sometimes people just saying, you know, I was without electricity, without my phone, without my computer, without my TV for 9 days, and I couldn't do anything. And it was really beautiful. And I actually got to know my neighbors who I never met before. And I thought there was something really kind of beautiful about that. On one hand, there's like, you know, it's this like literally awesome, terrifying thing that you'd think you'd want to like run away from. At the same time, it's also part of just what makes us who we are and what makes us a community and like brings out actually some of the best in us as well.
Yeah, it's like a
I thought that would be a good subject.
It's a weirdly cathartic experience in a way, because it's like this great crescendo of like a catastrophic event, and then afterwards it's just quiet, because and I would echo exactly what you're saying. I mean, after Ike happened, all of my neighbors were outside cleaning up the streets, people I'd never even talked to. My next door neighbors offered me a beer at 11 o'clock in the morning. You know, I mean, it was, you know, just weird stuff like that. And it was like, and there's no power, so you're kind of, what else are you going to do? You're going to talk to people in a way that you just don't most of the time when you're, you know, holed up in your little bubble. But that is so interesting that, so you took this very unique experience and thought, well, I have to tell this story. But you also incorporated events from the big one that hit Galveston.
Yeah.
We should explain what that is.
Absolutely. So, yeah. So I didn't actually know about this before I moved to Houston. But once, you know, I started like wanting to find out more about hurricanes, like the very first thing that comes up is the Great Storm of 1900 in Galveston. And that to this day is still the deadliest natural disaster that has ever struck the United States.
Wow.
We know it killed 6,000 people. Some people say it was as many as 9,000. It's really unimaginable. And of course, you know, before that, Galveston, you know, was Houston's big rival for the big trade center in the south of Texas. And of course, like this, like completely transformed the city. They literally raised the city up and they built the seawall. But before that, actually, the Great Storm of 1900 was a less powerful storm than Ike. But the because it the island was completely flat, the sea just sort of literally just like washed over the island, just you know, carrying away houses, these winds picking up like the roof off of places, and like, you know, people were, you know, all sorts of grisly things were happening to people from just like all the debris that was swirling around. It was really one of the most horrible things that ever like struck the United States. And so that's, and that's something that really has permanently marked the island. I mean, you go around there, it's this beautiful place. People are so unbelievably friendly and it's really great. But there's almost this very deliberate sense in which like it's that there's a sense that it's haunted, you know, that that this that they had such a great catastrophe happen there. And I think that, you know, even now when they say, if you are in Galveston and you just say the storm, you're talking about the Great Storm of 1900. I mean, that's how present it is for people even now. And so it's felt that like you couldn't really tell a story about this region and, you know, sort of what our recent experiences are and what our future experiences might be without sort of reckoning with this, like, you know, big granddaddy of them all.
Well, so I think we've given people a good sense of just the horrific nature of what this area and what Galveston have experienced with these kinds of storms. I want to know now about your musical inspirations and your creative process of writing this with librettist Stephanie Fleischman.
Yeah, who is really an extraordinary artist, an extraordinary collaborator. And we also were working hand in hand the entire way with our director, Matthew Ozawa. And he visualized this in the most stunning way. And I think the big place that we started off from, we were going to do a chamber opera about a hurricane. That sounds crazy. I mean, do a grand opera about a hurricane, right? Like when you have the full chorus and when you have like the full orchestra and, you know, you can augment that to, you know, however many players, because right of hurricane, you want like the biggest thing possible, right? And we deliberately were going absolutely almost counterintuitively in the opposite direction. And the reasoning was that sort of, you know, no matter how big we make this, and even if we had all the money in the world and could come up with like really Hollywood level kind of very literal allusions that would portray like the storm, like it would always be disappointing when you compare it to the real thing, right? I mean, like we'd all of these Houstonians and Galvestonians would be there, and you know, it would be such a pale facsimile, almost like the more that it would try to mimic it exactly, the more like, you know, it would, you would be very conscious of how like this is not actually anywhere near like a big, a real hurricane. So I think one of like the big kind of generating ideas that we had was, how can we, instead of just like literally portray a hurricane, how can we use images and music to create a, basically a storm of the mind, where we're suggesting a lot of things without necessarily always spelling it out. So, I mean, from a visual perspective, one of the things that Matthew did, which was like incredibly brilliant, is that he surrounded the whole playing space by these poles that had this wire on each side. So basically kind of like formed like a square. And in our opera, as the water is rising, as it was doing catastrophically in Ike, we have members of our ensemble just moving this wire line higher and higher. And it's very, very simple and it's very, very spare. But in some ways that is, was so much more chilling and evocative than if we like flooded the stage with water. And I was, the whole time was like trying to look for musical analogs of that, and always kind of a lot of times trying to like zig where I thought that there might be an expectation for me to zag. So actually like the amount of time in the opera where, you know, it's really kind of loud, sort of like a hurricane sounds, it's actually, it's like a very, very short amount of time. And actually even the very first prologue, when everybody is singing about the devastation of the great storm of 1900, it's actually very kind of like sparse and beautiful. I think we're always trying to find these other ways into it other than, you know, what felt like the obvious choice. And one of the, one of my favorite scenes in the opera, which is the scene where the water level rises as much as it does, is all basically based on sort of like the feeling that, well, one of the really musical things, I mean, storms are very, very musical themselves, right? I mean, a hurricane has its own sort of structure. I mean, it's coming and it's coming and it's getting closer and closer. And so there's a, there's a certain amount of musical anticipation in that. I mean, the quiet before the storm is one of the things that we always talk about. I mean, that's
Which is such a musical thing.
I mean, it's so incredible that you could have something set, that silence could hold that much tension. And that was something I was thinking a lot about in this, that it wasn't going to all about being loud. That wasn't always going to be the most exciting thing that we could do. And then, of course, you know, you have this like form of the storm with like, you know, the first half, then the eye, where again, everything is completely silent, but it's a silence of a very particular character. And then the back half, which is so much, which is even more violent. And like looking sort of like, how do we like actually use the sort of the very structure of a hurricane itself to create music? So in the second scene, it's actually the whole first part of this theme, it just starts out with this like one little interval. It just goes da-dum. And we wait, and then again, da-dum.
We stay. We good men, we stay. We ride out the storm, come what may. Well stocked.
And various things start getting sort of layered over it, and it gets, the motif just gets a little bit higher and higher, as if sort of the water is rising along with the pitch.
Water's coming in. Water's coming in, coming in. Water's coming in under the door.
But it's this sort of like slow, kind of like gradual process for our character as she realizes, oh my God, this water is getting higher and higher than I ever thought. But it's like a very different sort of thing than just, you know, rattling around with like the noisiest things that you can find in the orchestra and having everybody freak out, which I don't think you could sustain for a 70-minute opera. So I think that that's the sort of the things that we're looking at for like musical inspiration is sort of how do we find sort of like other ways into it in which we're really going to engage everybody's imagination rather than presenting things in the most literal way possible. And that was really, that felt really effective because when we were then talking to people afterwards, I mean, we did some sort of sounds that you don't normally hear in an opera house. In which some people who I presume are going to the opera all the time, they're certainly not hearing, you know, on whatever radio stations they may be listening to. But, like, no one ever came up to me and said, like, why did you have the violins do that? That sounded so weird. I've never heard a violin do that. They just will say, like, oh, wow, that really sounded like the storm. That really sounded like what it was like. And I think I really like that. It kind of gets back to, like, the whole HGOCO mission in some ways of sort of I was doing some things that, like, in some, you know, quarters might be thinking like, oh, that's a sort of a crazy thing. That's sort of an experimental thing to do. Mm-hmm. Although there was nothing I was doing, I think that's that far out. But then like no one really was sort of conscious of that, of like, oh, he's like experimenting. Oh, he's doing things that are like unusual. Mm-hmm. They just heard the story that mm-hmm. we were telling. And to me, that's kind of how you would want to approach everything, whether it's, you know, something that we're doing, an opera that was written yesterday or something 300 years ago.
Apparently, you used some of our Houston Public Media news anchors in the production of the story, their voices at least.
Yeah. We had some, it was so much fun to record. We had some sort of newscasts that were really important, both as a sort of a theme. We do a lot with radios in the opera, and also as just sort of expositions, because we jump around in time. So having someone saying that Hurricane Cassie, our fictional hurricane, is going on was helpful, as opposed to someone has a newscast about Hurricane Ike.
With sustained winds of 120 miles per hour, Hurricane Cassie is rapidly bearing down on the Gulf Coast. A 24-foot surge at peak storm time to bring unprecedented flooding.
It was a real delight to come in and record with the folks at HPM, because, you know, I've listened to those radio stations for years. There's some of my favorite. And so to get to sort of include them in like the opera was just personally a really neat thing for me.
Well, and that's such a great creative touch, too, because that's such a part of the storm experience, or I'm sure other catastrophic events, too, like that newscaster's voice playing in the background. You know, telling you, oh, the water's risen another foot, and run for the hills.
And also that there's something just like specifically about radio.
Yeah.
It's something that we get even when, like, you know, the power has gone off. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was, it almost seemed like sort of like an Ike, like, you know, it seemed like all the people on the radio were almost sort of like priests, you know, gathering the community like together. And there was something just so beautiful about like people kind of using that as a sort of like as a virtual meeting place when, like, you know, all other sort of avenues that they would have for that, usually they didn't. So, yeah, I mean, it seemed very, very natural that radio would be a big part of our story.
Yeah. What's interesting is during the course of our conversation right now, I'm looking out the window and the entire downtown skyline has been completely engulfed in a rainstorm, and I think we're actually capturing some of the thunder happening outside while
you and I
are talking. And it looks really creepy out there. And I think it's Houston has been increasingly experiencing these major downpours. We had two 500-year floods in about a month.
Right.
I find that what's happening here, your opera is so timely because the storm issue here in Houston, which is a major and increasing problem here. So,
yeah.
So is that something that is coming from you? Is that something that comes from HGOCO?
I think it's something that comes from HGOCO, but of course it attracts people like me for whom like that kind of work is our life's blood. I mean, I think that sometimes there's a perception of opera that is this archaic art form of people wearing, you know, old 18th, 19th century clothes, singing about things that maybe don't concern us as much as they used to, that there almost has to be this sort of, you know, this sort of leap into a completely different aesthetic than what we have just, you know, as like Jewish Mos Americans growing up. Whether that's true or not, you know, is another discussion. But I think there's certainly that perception. And so, you know, one thing you can do, of course, is show how actually like all these like great classical works, there's a lot more going on than that perception. But another thing is to just create works, new works, that directly deal with, you know, what we're thinking about today, and show that there's like some important things that you can say through musical storytelling. And of course, that's it's really wonderful to have done these works and to find all these connections with all these people who never imagined that an opera would be a vehicle to tell their story, much less an effective and really moving one. And when that does actually come to pass, and you make those connections with people, and they're, you know, pleased and proud and like and gratified to be portrayed on stage, issues that are very important to them. I mean, it's one of like the great feelings.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I mean, it's great. And I mean, like, what a fantastic way to bring something that may previously seem so entirely foreign right to people, that, you know, and just make it so relevant to them as to talk about their lives.
Yeah, I always feel like, you know, context is such a big part of it, because things that seem sort of unfamiliar and forbidding, like, for instance, like, I go to classical music things all the time, and, you know, I enjoy them, and I, you know, I'm totally fine with the etiquette of all of it. But I have to say, actually, when I was a college student, and I kind of grew up much more, I think, on classical music recordings than I went to a ton of concerts as a kid. I went to some, but not so much that when I started going in college, I was really, really confused when, you know, the performers would come out and we'd clap, because wait, they haven't done anything yet. Why are we should clap at the end after we've like approved of it. And of course, like now, I mean, like I love it, but you know, it's something that people talk about, is that sometimes they're just like nervous about going to a classical music concert, because they're like, oh, there's this etiquette to it, and what if I get it wrong and people are mad at me? And it's easy to see that, you know, if someone, you know, has that fear, they won't want to go encounter it. So being able to sort of, you know, kind of do an end run around all of that stuff and present things really directly to people, and have like, no, this is not something where it's like, are you good enough like to come here and sort of, and you know, go into the church of classical music, but this is something that we want to learn from you, and we want to interact with you, and we want to find like what is the way that we can connect with you, rather than, you know, can you come to us? You know, that's a really inspiring way to me of doing things.
What a great approach. And I love that term, the church of classical music, because it totally is like that. I mean, as I've told you, like, I come from a non-classical music world. And so this is all new to me. And when I go to performances, my default setting has been to just sit there and watch everyone and then copy what they're doing.
And it's so hard, because it's also just like, it depends so much on, I mean, we say classical music, but we're talking about like centuries of things, and which like the way that like audiences may have like, you know, taken in 14th century mass, I mean, it's completely different from the way that they would have like taken in like an Italian opera aria, you know, where they might have not have even been paying attention to the first time they sing the aria until they repeat it, and then they do all the ornaments. And of course, now we kind of treat everything sort of all in the same way, but it used to be like all these different audiences from all these different times and all these different geographic locations, Italy, Germany, you know, they all had their own different ways of sort of interacting with things. And, you know, we're trying to find like the right etiquette that fits everybody. But I mean, it's really, it's an artificial thing that we're making up. And so, again, it's great to create contexts where we can just find our own way of doing it.
Well, and what made you sort of specially equipped to deal with these things that kind of require not only your knowledge of opera and of classical music, but of sort of being in the community and working with other people outside of that world?
Well, it's because I never have exclusively been a classical musician. And actually, there was even a time in my life I thought maybe I'll be some other kind of musician. You know, like think like just about every composer, you know, I had my rock bands growing up, and, you know, I played jazz piano and many other things besides. And actually, where I went to college was Wesleyan University, which has one of the nation's really great ethnomusicology programs. And you get to, you know, sample a lot of different ways of thinking about music. So one of the things that was a really, really good fit for that project and a lot of other HGO co-projects along similar lines, where we're combining different traditions, is that sort of my training is not just in classical music, but in figuring out how do other people think about music and how is that different from how classical musicians think about it and where are the points of intersection. And that's a really, really exciting thing for me. And I'm really glad I've been able to work on a lot of projects that have called that into play.
That's cool. So you have kind of this sort of broad view of music in general.
I try to at least.
Well, David Hanlon, I wanted to thank you so much for being on the program today. This has been a really great talk, and I hope you come back to the show.
Oh, I'd love to. And yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
All right, everybody, that does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom. You can follow us on the Twitters, the Tumblrs, the YouTubes, and the SoundClouds. Email me at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org. You can rate and review us on iTunes because of the wonderful things we does. Thanks today to audio producer Todd Typhoon Todd Holslander for twiddling knobs. Thanks to editor Mark DiClaudio for his piercing lightning eyes. Thanks to David Hanlon for being here today. Thanks to Toby Schreiner for engineering over at WAMU. Thanks to me for saying words. But most of all, thanks to you for being here. We'll catch you next time.